This episode is brought to you in part by The Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
This episode of Quick to Listen is sponsored in part by Start Church, a company for pastors and ministry leaders that helps get started the right way. You can learn more about them at startchurch.com. It's Wednesday, December 19th, and this is Quick to Listen, where we set aside hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. On today's show, Bishop Michael Nazarali joins us to discuss religious freedom in Pakistan. Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Morgan Lee, Associate Digital Media Producer here at Christianity Today. I'm joined by my co-host, our Editor-in-Chief, Mark Galley.
Good early morning.
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Good.
All right. Well, it's not so early for our guest this morning. So who is our guest and where are we talking to him?
Our guest is Bishop Michael Nazarali. He formerly served as Bishop of Raiwand and Church of Pakistan, as well as serving in the Church of England as the Bishop of Rochester. He was formerly General Secretary of the Church Mission Society, and he's now director of the Oxford Center for Training, Research, Advocacy, and Dialogue. And as a dual citizen, both Pakistan and Britain, he has a good perspective to share with us on our topic today. Welcome, Bishop Michael.
Thank you, sir.
It's great to have you. How's everything going on in the UK? We know it's very calm and peaceful politically over there right now.
Well, it's very confused, I think, is the right word. But it's the weather is very cold, so you'll sympathize with that, no doubt.
Well, I'm excited because I will be going to London for the first time in a couple of days.
Oh, you will? Oh, well, you'll come to quite a cold London then, I'm afraid.
Listen, I live in cold Chicago. I think I'll be prepared.
Yes, yes. Well, people in Chicago are.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm really looking forward to doing a deep dive into the country of Pakistan. And so I'm just going to give everyone an overview about what we'll be talking about today. Recently, Pakistan's Supreme Court acquitted Aja Bibi of blasphemy charges. After nearly a decade behind bars and on death row, the mother of five was released. After the verdict was announced, many in Pakistan responded in anger, with protests erupting around the country in Islamabad, Lahore, and Karachi. Her family is currently in hiding and seeking asylum in a different country. Pakistan also recently kicked out 18 international non-governmental organizations, including the Christian nonprofit World Vision. The country is currently ranked as number 5 on the 2018 World Watch list of 50 countries where it's hardest to be a Christian. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom also classifies Pakistan as a Tier 1 country of particular concern. And this September, the U.S. cut $300 million in military aid to Pakistan. So this week on Quick to Listen, we'll talk about what's going on with religious freedom in this country and what the latest with Aja Bibi is and a lot of other issues that are extremely important to the Christians there and for the Christians around the world who care about this country. Before we get into asking Bishop Michael all of our questions, Mark, I want to just take us back to this Aja Bibi verdict, which was now a couple weeks ago, and wondering if you have any gut check for this decision by the Supreme Court.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised, happily surprised that they did that. I actually didn't have much hope that she would come out of this. She still hasn't. She's still in the country, and there's still a lot of anger about it. And it shows a fair amount of courage on Pakistan's Supreme Court to make a decision that they knew would be very unpopular. So,
yeah, I'm with you as far as being surprised because, as we know, part of the reason it was all the way there on the Supreme Court was just because this case does not seem to end. I feel like I've been covering it since I've been in religion reporting.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. I hadn't put two and two together that she was in prison for 10 years, so that's quite admirable for her to maintain her faith. There's a story there for the larger world at some point.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Bishop Michael, as we've just been saying right here, this saga has been playing out for a number of years. But for our listeners who are maybe just hearing about this for the first time right now, can you remind us of how it all got started?
Yes, it got started when Asia Bibi, who is a farmhand, she does casual labor on farms as many poorer Christians in Pakistan do. She was asked whether she wanted to go into a farm and pick berries. And there were other women doing the same thing, and they were mostly Muslim women. My understanding is that she offered to get a pot of water for them to drink from because it was a hot day. And when she got this pot of water, she drank from it first, and that elicited protest from the Muslim women who said that she'd made the water unclean because she was a Christian, and they invited her to become a Muslim. She is then supposed to have said to them, my Jesus died for me. My Jesus died for me. What has your prophet done for you? I think this is the sum total of the allegation against her, that by saying these things, she committed blasphemy against the prophet, which is, of course, punishable in Pakistan by a mandatory death sentence. So that's how it all began.
It started out then, you're saying, as the way it seems like many of these blasphemy cases start out, with kind of a very hyper-local, hyper-interpersonal dispute. And so how exactly did it kind of turn into something that the Pakistan Supreme Court was weighing in on?
Well, the women involved the local imam of the mosque, who actually laid the charges first in the lower courts against Asia Bibi, and she was convicted in those courts. It quite often happens that the lower courts convict because of the tremendous intimidation that they come under from local extremists. And in other cases also, the higher courts have in fact acquitted from time to time people accused of blasphemy. In fact, one high court judge who had acquitted someone was himself killed. There is, you know, as you were saying earlier, Mark, it's quite brave of the Supreme Court to have done what it did. You know, it's been going through the courts, and of course she's been held all this time. I think it's about 8 years or so, to be exact.
You know, for someone like her, from some reports, it seemed like she was not super well educated nor financially well resourced. How was she able to afford legal representation during this time and even find people who were willing enough to put their own lives at risk to represent her?
Yes, well, the lawyer, her lawyer has been a Muslim lawyer, and he's himself now in exile, and he's been very brave as well. I think people have helped her and the family. One of the elements in this has been that whilst there's been a lot of publicity and people have come and written stories about her and so on, that the financial needs have not been adequately met for the family. A school had made free places available for the children, but the father still needed to provide uniforms and, you know, books and those sorts of things that you need in a school. And he, of course, he can't work because he is in danger. And but people have helped. I think they could have helped more, but people have helped. And they have been able to get, as it happens, very good legal, very brave, very courageous legal assistance. But, you know, the long-term financial situation also is unclear.
All right. Well, I want to talk at length about blasphemy laws, but I think before we get into that, it's going to be helpful if we can just talk about Pakistan for a second. So first of all, it's an extremely enormous country. It's nearly three times the size of Germany when it comes to population. But I don't think many of our listeners actually know a lot about it. Can we start with some of the obvious questions, like what other countries does it border and what are the different types of communities that live there?
Well, Pakistan is a sort of cockpit. It is surrounded by other countries. So on the eastern side, of course, is the very large country of India. And then in the northeast, we have China. Then moving true north, there is a sort of point border, not very extensive, a point border with Tajikistan, that, you know, Central Asia. Then on the west, you have Afghanistan and Iran. Then in the south, you have the Gulf, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf countries across. So it is very strategically placed as a country, and this also is significant for what happens. The communities, 60% of the country is the province of the Punjab, which means that the majority of people, including the majority of Christians, are Punjabis. Then there is Sindh in the south, which includes the city of Karachi. The province of Sindh gets its name from the river Indus or Sindus, from which, of course, the whole of the subcontinent is named. We have Balochistan, a province in the west, which is shared with Iran. The Punjab is shared with India and Balochistan with Iran.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And then we have what they now called Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, which used to be called the Northwestern Frontier province, which has a very long border with Afghanistan. And the people there, the Pakhtun people, live on both sides of the border. So there are many Afghan Pakhtuns and many Pakistani Pakhtuns, just as there are Irani Baloch and Pakistani Baloch, and Indian Punjabis and Pakistani Punjabis, and so on.
May I ask where your family's from?
My family is from the middle, from a place called Bahawalpur, which used to be, I don't know if you remember, but in British India, there used to be princely states that were not part of British India. They had their own kind of system of government and so on, and this was one of those states.
So when we are thinking of the Christian population in Pakistan, where are they most likely to be in the country?
Yeah, they're all over. They're dispersed, but the concentrations are in the city of Lahore, which is the second largest city near and in Sialkot, where a lot of the sports goods and surgical goods are made. It's on the western side in Faisalabad. Yeah, they're all over Multan, which is in the middle of the country. And of course, there are large numbers in Karachi as well, which is the port city, the main port city.
I just was also wondering if you can just give us a sense of the country religiously as well. Clearly, this country is overwhelmingly Muslim, but, you know, would you say that most people are extremely devout, or is this a country where it's kind of a more cultural faith that is practiced?
When Pakistan came into existence at the time of the partition of undivided India, the numbers of non-Muslims were much greater because East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh, was of course also part of Pakistan. So it was about 75% Muslim, 25% non-Muslim. And that's a very significant. But since the separation of East Pakistan from the country, the remaining country, West Pakistan, is, as you say, overwhelmingly over 90% Muslim. But there are still, I mean, the exact number of Christians is not known. The government figure is artificially depressed and has been for many years, which is not in itself an anti-Christian thing. It's so that the extremists don't react. But my own feeling is that the numbers of Christians are about between 3-4% of the population. Some Christians give a much higher figure. The government gives a lower figure. But I think the truth is so often in between. Then there is a similar number of Hindus who have remained in Pakistan. There are small communities of Sikhs. There used to be a small community of Jews, but they have mostly emigrated to Israel and elsewhere. And there are some people who belong to ancient religions, especially in the mountains.
So when we are thinking of the Christian population in Pakistan, how far does this date back to?
There is the story of St. Thomas the Apostle coming to what is now Pakistan in Taxila. That event is commemorated, and there is some historical evidence for this. But the continuous Christian communities date from about the 16th century. The oldest church in Pakistan is in the city of Lahore, and it dates from about 590-something. And then when the modern missionary movement began, towards the end of the 18th century, people began coming to Christ and churches were formed. The first Anglican, I know Mark is an Anglican over there, the first Anglican to be ordained was ordained in 1823. And that's probably parallel in other churches as well. There was then a mass movement of landless peasant type people in the last quarter of the 19th century. And the bulk of the Christian population comes from these people who were landless, they were casual labor, just as Asia Bibi is, and were discriminated against and despised by many of the wealthier people around.
Thank you for giving us all this background information and info. You just mentioned right now that many of these really poor Christians were kind of despised and unliked. Was that, in your accounting, because this group was poor? Or is there this longer running thread of persecution against Christians in Pakistan?
Well, it's a bit of both, to be honest. I think some of it has to do with the remains of the caste system, that although Islam doesn't have a caste system, in fact, the caste system still works in Pakistan. And many of these people were from the lower castes, just as many Muslims are. But of course, once you become a Muslim, that becomes your dominant identity badge. But for these people, their background, the professions that they were allowed to engage in, many of them were landless labor or in tanning. When Pakistan was created, a lot of them were uprooted from their landless peasantry because of the exchange of populations at the time. And they found themselves in the big cities where the only skill they had was to go into street cleaning and things like that. So they then became associated with working as sanitation workers in the big cities. So that's part of it. But of course, since the emergence of extremism and its emphasis on Islamic identity, and then of course being a Christian also means that you're regarded as ritually unclean, ritually impure. And the fear is that, eating with you or whatever will make people impure for prayer or fasting or whatever it may be. So it's a bit of both.
From what I understand as well, that there's some extent to which persecution against Christians is kind of a spillover of persecution that's also directed at the Ahmadi community. Is that a correct assumption?
It's not a spillover. I think there are different reasons for each. The Ahmadiyya community is discriminated against and persecuted because they are alleged to pretend to be Muslims, which they are not allowed to do. They were declared non-Muslim by an act of parliament in the 1970s. But of course, they still regard themselves as Muslim, and all their rituals and their religious life is ordered in that way. So each time something like that happens, there is some kind of move against them. Yeah, their situation is very, very difficult indeed, because they are in danger of becoming non-persons in the sense that they cannot take part actively in the life of the country, the political life, social life of the country.
So you mentioned the rise of extremism in Pakistan. And when did that first start happening?
How long is a piece of string? I mean, it goes back to almost to the origins. The people who founded Pakistan did not establish it as a theocratic state. They were mainly secular-minded or moderate-minded Muslims who wanted to create a home for Muslims that was based on history and culture and things like that. By the way, the Christian communities actively supported the creation of Pakistan. And in fact, during the decision-making processes and the assemblies and so on, it was because of the Christian vote that Pakistan was created, because at one stage, the whole thing was gridlocked. It was the Christian, the voting by Christians that actually turned the scales in favor of the creation of Pakistan. And the Christians did so because they thought that one minority that had an experience of oppression in undivided India would be good to another minority that had experience of oppression. That has not turned out to be the case, but that was how it was thought to be at the time. Anyway, the extremists, in fact, at that time, were against the creation of Pakistan because they didn't trust the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was a very liberal Muslim. And also they felt that the creation of Pakistan would divide the Muslim strength in India, which of course it has done. There were riots against the Ahmadis already in the 50s, which were suppressed. But really, extremism in the form that we encounter it today came into prominence in the 80s when General ضیاء-الحق became the president. And he used extremism to legitimize his regime. This was also the time when Western powers, the United States, the United Kingdom, European countries, were encouraging Islamist extremists to wage a jihad against the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. And Pakistan, of course, was used for this as a conduit for arms and finance and training. That also raised the profile of extremism to a very significant extent. Since then, we've had this danger on the doorstep all the time.
All right. I think I've asked a lot of background questions. Finally ready to talk about blasphemy laws. Seriously, this is really good stuff. So I appreciate you laying this foundation. So why don't you tell us a little bit about when blasphemy laws first emerged and when they went into effect?
Well, the background is, and sometimes you will hear government representatives in Pakistan saying that the blasphemy laws date back to British times. So why are you criticizing us? Well, what is true is that the British had a law in India which was against incitement to religious hatred. They realized that in a country like undivided India, that the communities had to be kept in harmony with one another, and communal strife was always a danger. But this was a law which is still on the statute books, which prescribed reasonable punishments against what might be regarded as incitement to religious hatred against any religion. How often this law was used is shown by the fact that since the creation of Pakistan up to the enactment of the present blasphemy laws, there were only a few prosecutions under this, the old law. This law was then amended in the 1980s and early 90s by General ضیاء-الحق and the governments that followed him to include a punishment for blasphemy against the Prophet of Islam, which was life imprisonment or death, and punishment against the desecration of the Quran, which was life imprisonment. Then in the 90s, the Sharia courts ruled that life imprisonment was not an option for blasphemy against the Prophet. The Sharia prescribed a mandatory death sentence. So that's really the, you know, that's where it all began. Numerous people, Muslims, Ahmadis, Christians, were arrested on a charge of blasphemy. Very often these charges are concocted either because somebody doesn't like you being present in their locality, or because they have some grudge against you, or they want to alienate you from your property, whatever. You know, all sorts of reasons are given for why these laws have been invoked.
This isn't the only Muslim country that has blasphemy laws with harsh penalties, is it? Or,
well, it is the only one which has this kind of mandatory punishment. I think there are other countries that have punishments against blasphemy. It may be that Saudi Arabia has such a punishment, but I can't think of any other country even Iran that would have this kind of punishment, extreme kind of punishment. Yeah.
What type of efforts have been taken, if any, to soften these laws or actually take them off the law books?
Well, different people have tried. General Musharraf, when he was the president, tried to amend the laws, but failed because of the backlash. As you know, when Asia Bibi was first arrested, the then governor of the Punjab, the biggest province in the country, went to see her in jail. And when he came out, he said that these laws were humanly made laws and they could be amended. Well, the next day, as he was coming out of a restaurant after having had lunch, he was shot 36 times by his own guard, who was then arrested and who then, during his trial and so on, became a hero with the extremists. And indeed, many of the people who demonstrated against Asia Bibi's acquittal are followers of this man. The only Christian minister in government was also assassinated at that time. And various MPs, members of parliament who tried to introduce moderate amendments to the blasphemy law, were threatened. Some of them are now in exile in the United States. So, yeah, I mean, people have tried both for a repeal of the law and for its amendment. I myself have said to successive governments that there are ways in which the registration of the case, the investigation of the case, the trial of the case can be made such by administrative means that it becomes very difficult to operate the law. Some few things have been done in this respect, but there's still a lot that could be done administratively to make it more difficult for people to allege blasphemy against others.
Hey, this is Morgan from Quick to Listen. This episode of Quick to Listen is sponsored in part by Start Church, a company for pastors and ministry leaders that helps get started the right way. And today I'm speaking with Nathan Camp. He's the VP of Strategy at Start Church. Nathan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me today.
So, Nathan, who started Start Church?
Our founder, Raul Rivera, was planting a church many years ago, and he really wanted to launch Compliant. And this is way back in the dial-up days, so he had to go to the library and study on how to do that. And he felt like the Lord spoke to him and said, if you'll study this, I'll help put you in all 50 states. And in that time, he kind of thought the Lord was talking to him about the church. But it ended up being that more and more people, more and more church planters, heard that his church had done it legally and asked for his help. And as he started helping and serving churches, it turned out to be, you know, today we start a lot of churches, you know, well over 1,000 churches a year. And so it all comes from the heart of a planter. Our major passion here is to help make something complex very simple for church planters and ministry leaders.
You can learn more about Start Church at startchurch.com.
This episode is brought to you by Church Law and Tax. Church Law and Tax understands the realities of church work, helping thousands of churches stay informed and get equipped with comprehensive resources on legal, tax, financial, and risk management matters. Do you have a question on housing allowance? Need information on selecting church insurance? Looking for insights on what is or isn't unrelated business income? Or how about some guidance on how to properly receive charitable contributions? ChurchLawAndTax.com equips you for success with access to the most respected and knowledgeable attorneys, accountants, financial advisors, and risk managers guiding churches today. Get the practical information and timely coverage you need to keep your church up to date and lead your ministry with confidence. Join ChurchLawAndTax.com today.
Have there been cases where people have, in fact, been executed for blasphemy?
No one has so far been executed for blasphemy in terms of law, but of course many people have been lynched. And this is the other danger. The law has created an atmosphere of extrajudicial action. mob attacks, and not just on the person accused, but on their community, on churches, the destruction of churches, the killing of people, destruction of property. So it is not just the application of the strict law, but the kind of atmosphere that it has created in the country.
Okay, well, that's pretty helpful.
Yeah, that's a good point with regards to what actually might have to change. What type of anti-extremist efforts does the government have going right now?
Well, in the past, people have talked about good extremism and bad extremism. This is the kind of nonsense that has allowed certain kinds of extremists to continue to survive.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yes. It is true that the government of Pakistan has acted against the Pakistani Taliban, for instance, not the Afghan Taliban, but the Pakistani version of them. But at the same time, it has given sanctuary to Afghan Taliban leaders. And this is something the United States, of course, has against the country at the moment, and to other groups like them. It has cracked down on those extremists who are engaging in terrorism within Pakistan, but equally there are others who are roaming around freely. So you have the paradox of a nation that has a parliamentary, that is a parliamentary democracy. The government has just changed, as you know. The higher courts, anyway, are reasonably free, as the Supreme Court decision shows. The press is free, almost too free, we may say, the media. And there is a civil society. So you have that on the one hand. On the other, you have extremists of every kind roaming around freely and doing whatever they wish to do.
Wow. That's a lot of different, interesting contradictions that you summed up right there.
No, but that's correct. It is a country of contradictions.
Well, and I think, obviously, Pakistan is not the size of China, but I just go back to when I was in China, one of my professors said, everything that you hear about China is true somewhere in China. And I tend to think that's true also for the United States and also for places that are that large as Pakistan as well, is that there's just so much diversity depending on what cities you live in, what part of the country you've located in, what conditions your family grew up in. And we just all happen to live in the same place that's a country. But even you mentioned at the beginning just the diversity of groups that are there.
Yes, I think some of this is due to diversity, but some of it is due to the fact that the country as such has used extremists on the one hand to advance its cause, which I believe to be a just cause in Kashmir. But of course, just causes can be advanced by unjust means. And also, on the other hand, to retain what the army calls strategic depth, which is to say that to make sure that in the West, in the Western part of the country, the Western part of the region, that nothing will happen that impedes Pakistan's interests there. So this has recently been recognized by the U.S., that any solution, any lasting solution to the Afghan problem will have to involve Pakistan. But this has, as I was saying, in the late 70s, early 80s, the Western powers encouraged Pakistan to encourage extremism.
It's our fault?
No, it's Pakistan's fault as well, but it's also the West. Yeah, considered. I mean, I remember this very clearly because I was working in the area at the time. And it was felt, I mean, Western foreign policy has felt for a long time during the Iron Curtain years that the only people who could challenge the expansion of Soviet Marxism were fundamentalist Muslims. And so it is part of foreign policy to encourage them.
There's a good book about it called Charlie Wilson's War that I recommend.
Right. Well, who was Charlie Wilson then?
A representative from the United States who you would say probably helped encourage extremism.
Yes, well, I'm sure there were many such. I mean, what I'm saying is nobody's innocent in this game.
Wow. Well, that is, I'm really glad, again, I tell people sometimes that I think this show is actually not about making complex things less complex, but making them more complex. I think we have.
Well, I hope it's also about making them more understandable.
Absolutely. But, you know, just trying to stay away from simple answers of why things are the way they are. So I want to go back to this Supreme Court decision. One thing that you had mentioned earlier was that it can be really challenging for local courts to kind of adjudicate things in a way that they may see as actually fair because of fear about what the local community might do, but that, you know, higher courts are able to sometimes, yeah, make different decisions without fear of these types of repercussions. Having still said that, though, did that still surprise you to see the Supreme Court rule in the way that it did?
Well, no, because as I was saying, the higher courts have acquitted in the past, and I was hopeful that the Supreme Court would do what it has done. However, its judgment is very complex. It's there are matters of concern for Christians in that judgment, as well as matters for joy and rejoicing.
Hmm. Yeah.
So the judgment is in three parts. Part two is about the lack of evidence against Asia Bibi. So the acquittal is based on the fact that there's just not enough evidence to convict. Part three is about the unreliability of the testimony of the on behalf of the prosecution, which of course also leads to a verdict of acquittal. But part one is at length a defense of the death penalty for blasphemy, and that can and will be used in the future by all sorts of elements to justify their position. And this has not been studied enough, I think, but it does deserve further study.
Do you think they included that clause just to help the rest of the country swallow the judgment?
Possibly. This is possible. But of course, you know, once you set a precedent in law, then that can be used in all sorts of...
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, no question about it. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking a lot about blasphemy laws, but as we mentioned in the beginning of the show, there's some other stuff that's also going on right now. I want to talk about Pakistan's decision to boot a lot of international non-governmental organizations. Now, Pakistan is not at all the first country in recent years to really try to kibosh these non-governmental organizations from working. Russia has put a lot of steps into place that make it really hard for these groups to exist. China has as well. There's some places in sub-Saharan Africa. But what's going on exactly with regards to Pakistan here and why they don't want their influence anymore?
I think this is partly to do with a growing suspicion of the West that Western agencies, particularly American agencies, are promoting American interests rather than Pakistani interests. And this came to a head, of course, with the Osama bin Laden situation when he was identified by the U.S. and killed. There was a suspicion then, and there still is now, that the way in which he was identified was through a foreign-sponsored medical program, which enabled the U.S. to identify the DNA of Osama bin Laden and his family. So that has created a climate of suspicion against these organizations. I mean, each of them, of course, varies from the other and is different from the other. So they're not all the same. But it is difficult for the authorities sometimes to see what the difference is. 18, as you say, have been expelled, but of course there are many more still working there. I have consistently argued that those agencies that have a record of service to Pakistan in education and medicine, and there are many such Christian agencies, that the government should acknowledge this service and allow them to continue to work. In some cases, this does happen. I mean, for instance, there is a Christian hospital right on the frontier between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And I was reading recently that the commander of the Pakistan Army was saying in that area. They've just celebrated the 150th anniversary, this hospital. And the Pakistani commander was saying that they and the Taliban, when they were fighting each other, had an agreement not to touch the hospital. So, you know, there is that as well. And there are, you know, many such examples can be given.
So you mentioned this growing distrust of the West right now. And at the top of the show, we talked about some of the efforts that the United States has taken at a diplomatic level to kind of move the country when it comes to religious freedom or when it comes to fighting religious extremism. Do you think any of those efforts are actually going to make any difference when it comes to improving the welfare of the Christians there?
Yes, I think, I think they will. Of course, this is hotly denied by Pakistan. The U.S. does, you know, if this U.S. does something, this is immediately, there is a statement saying this will not have any effect, etc. But it does. And what is put out for public consumption is not necessarily what happens. I think that the present government is aware of Pakistan's standing in the Committee of Nations. For instance, Pakistan has the equivalent of most favored nation in trading with the EU, and it is seeking such a status with Britain when Britain leaves the EU. Many people have said to both EU officials and now to British officials that this status must depend on respect for human rights in Pakistan. That includes religious freedom, of course. And it may be that the U.S. is also saying such things in terms of its relationship with Pakistan. I know the military aid situation is tied more to how much Pakistan cooperates with bringing about peace in Afghanistan, and it's a slightly different matter. Yeah, the five-yearly review of the United Nations Council on Human Rights pinpointed many of the areas that we've been discussing that need reform in Pakistan. So everybody's aware of these things.
Well, I've really appreciated this big picture of issues that you've walked us through. And I'm wondering, Bishop Michael, if you would be willing to just share a little bit of your family's story of being Christian in Pakistan.
Yes, I don't particularly have a family story of being Christian in Pakistan because I come from a largely Muslim family. But I have my own story of ministry there and mission there. And I mean, we grew up in a country where Christians and Muslims and Hindus and Jews, I had Jewish boys in my class in school, all lived together very happily and respected each other's faith and situation. And that has changed radically over the years because of the rise of extremism. This is greatly to be regretted, not just by non-Muslims, by Christians and others, but also by Muslims themselves, because they, by not being able to live in an open society where people are content anyway to live cheek by jowl with others, this impoverishes the whole nation. So again and again, politicians say they want a moderate and liberal and open Pakistan. But this will have to come through struggle. And capitulating to extremists every time they threaten something is not going to bring back such a Pakistan. And we need some backbone, therefore, in resisting extra-legal, extrajudicial action which prevents justice being made available to people who are marginalized, who are discriminated against. Now, this has to come from within Pakistan and the establishment there, the Pakistan government, the courts, the media, but it can be encouraged by friends of Pakistan outside as well.
Well, thank you so much for getting into all of this. It was such a really great conversation, and it gives us a lot of more nuance with how to understand what's going on in that part of the world.
Well, thank you for asking.
If people have feedback that they would like to give, they can do that by going on Twitter. We're at CT Podcast. They can also send us an email at podcast@christianitytoday.com. com. With issues like these, there's always a lot more than we can, a lot more to get into than what we can tackle in a single show or even in an hour. But I'm really glad we could talk about this today. Before we move on to the end of our show, I just want to take this time to just thank everyone who has supported Christianity Today and our podcast all year. Really, it's been a huge help just to hear your words of feedback, but also all of you who gave financially. It would really just not be possible with all of you. And I just want to remind everyone that if you want to continue to support this podcast and to keep it free, which I don't know how you would make podcasts not free, but whatever. If you want to keep to supporting it, we all know that you'd want to do that. You can do that by going to morect.com/podcast. That's morect.com/podcast. And, you know, at various times this year, we've just tried to give you a sense of the different work that we do here at CT. And so today, for instance, I will be attending a conference that is addressing issues of Me Too and Church Too in an evangelical setting, which should be really interesting. And I'll be doing some reporting on that from that conference as well. Mark and I go to a number of conferences. I think you're probably the conference king, though. Would that be right, Mark?
For better or for worse.
Exactly. Chatting with people and reporting on things, but also trying to build partnerships and relationships, which is a huge thing that's become part of your work too, Mark. I thank you.
Yeah, I think a lot of the conferences, it's important Christianity Today signal that we think what's going on at the conference, the causes that are being supported, that we're supporting them. We agree with them because a lot of the things that people are doing in the world, like seeking moderation in Pakistan or religious freedom there, it's a lonely cause, and people need to know they have allies.
Absolutely. All right. Well, again, thank you everyone who supports our work. And if you'd like to continue doing that and supporting this podcast, again, you can go to morect.com/podcasts, morect.com/podcasts. We are in the part of the show that we call Precious Moments, which is when we ask everyone to share something that has brought them joy recently. Mark, please go.
What brought me joy was last night we had our end of the fall semester meeting of what I call, a theology group I'm a part of called Brewing Theology. And we usually read a book and discuss it. But last night we watched a movie, and it's a movie I don't know if I recommend. It's called First Reformed.
I was going to guess that. Yeah. Yes. Score.
That had an unsatisfactory ending as far as we were concerned, but it is about a pastor's struggle with an extremist environmentalist, and then he becomes taken with his cause, and he's obviously a deeply disturbed pastor. I don't mean that negatively. I just mean he has a lot going on in his head that it's hard for him to think clearly. At any rate, I don't want to give away the story, but it was a delight to be with friends, enjoy some Christmas treats, watch a movie, discuss it, and that's just the end of our fall semester. We'll get ready. We'll probably not meet until January again, pick up another book and dive into it. So it's been one of the pleasures of my life to be a part of that group.
That's awesome, Mark. All right. Tell people about your newsletter.
It is called The Galley Report. It can be found at christianitytoday/ The Galley Report, G-A-L-L-I. It's a weekly newsletter that I publish, thanks to the good people at Christianity Today who actually get it published. I just write the copy for it. I link to articles and comment on them. It's a very simple idea, and apparently some people like it, so you might as well.
Bishop Michael?
Yes, I met an Ethiopian pastor recently who works in London, and he was telling me how he has been promoting this whole idea of gratitude amongst Christians and in his community, that we've become a culture of complaint and of victimhood. And he was saying that actually true fulfillment as Christians comes from expressing our gratitude to other people who may be the reason for our earning our living, to those who help us, doctors, nurses, community workers, to our local communities, to the nation, and of course, grounding it all in our gratitude to God for life and salvation. So I thought that was, for me, that it's a very timely reminder at this time particularly of being thankful.
Yeah, I will say a big amen to that. I heard a homily about similar things recently, and I vowed in conjunction with the homily to every day note three things I'm thankful for.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I haven't kept it up, but your reminder, your precious moment is a good reminder for me to get back into doing that.
What are the three things? And what are they today?
Today they will be, I hate to, you know, hate to flatter you, Bishop, but getting to meet you and the work and the way in which you talk about the situation there. You seem to be have a really fair-minded understanding of what's going on without being hypercritical, I should say. You seem to approach it truthfully and charitably in a very complex situation in which there is a lot of injustice going on. And then I would have to say Morgan. So anyway.
You are into flattery.
I am into flattery right now. But you're asking me right now what I'm thankful for. And these are the things I'm listening to and looking at. And I'm looking at a Christmas tree outside the window of the studio. And it's full of white lights, which are always a pleasure. Always bring me joy. So there you go. There's my three things for today.
Bishop Michael, is there a website or social media or book that you want to point people to of yours where they can find you after the show ends?
Yes, I think if they Google my name, they will get to our website and they can look at that. And I've got a newish, not really new any longer. My last book was called Faith, Freedom, and the Future, Challenges for the 21st Century, which has a section on some of the things we've been discussing.
And do you mind spelling your last name for people?
Yes, Nazir -Ali.
All right. Thank you. My precious moment is, I can't remember if I mentioned on the show or not, but I visited Taizé, which is a ecumenical Christian community in France. I was there a couple weeks ago. And they have extremely beautiful music that is essentially scripture that you are singing repetitively over and over again during the three services that they have throughout the day. And almost all of the music is available on Spotify, which is awesome. So I have actually been listening to their music a lot since I've gotten back. And at times I've found it challenging to figure out how to pray. And I've really enjoyed praying through singing these songs and I'm grateful for this ability to connect with God that way.
And you realize there's a monthly Taizé service in
there's
Chicago
actually
off of Harlem?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a pretty vibrant.
Yeah, my wife organizes a monthly meeting. It's a light supper at our home and then a group goes to enjoy Taizé afterwards.
Yeah, I'm going to be checking some of them out in the upcoming year.
Did you spend the night there?
I actually spent 7 days there.
Oh, you did. So, and did you have any bed sheets?
You have to bring your own.
Yeah.
So no, I did not. Well, right. I mean, I have the ones that I brought, but no.
Right. I'm glad you did bring them because I didn't.
I'm sorry to hear that. Did you have to use one of the wool blankets that they have?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
That's okay. It's like sleeping with a hair shirt on. So
that's exactly what it feels like. Yeah.
Yes, Taizé, I would say, very simple, very basic, and they're not very, they're kind of unapologetic about that, their simpleness, which is kind of makes for a very interesting experience, especially for someone who's American and used to these kind of decked out religious retreats.
Yes, you don't get many choices about food, do you?
Nope, not that either. I told people that breakfast was white bread and chocolate bars,
yeah.
Among other things. When did you go, Bishop Michael?
Oh, a long time ago. I was there in the 70s.
Okay. I'm glad to know they use the same wool blankets.
Yeah, so probably.
But really, though, did you go when you had to sleep in one of the dormitories, or did you sleep in a tent?
Yes. Yeah. No, it was a dormitory, and it was bunk beds.
Oh, yeah. I slept in one, too.
Yeah.
Maybe the same one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's obviously not changed very much.
No, in fact, they let us know that they recently changed the sanctuary decorations in the past 6 months, and that the brother who was in charge of changing the sanctuary decorations received a lot of feedback about how the new sanctuary decorations should look, because you can imagine, I think they hadn't changed them in like 30 years. So it was a little bit controversial. All right, people can find me on Twitter at MEPAYNL. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. This podcast is produced by myself, Richard Clark, and Cray Allred. The theme music is by Sweeps. You can find this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you end up listening to it on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review the show. Again, if you want to support the work that we do here at Christianity Today, you can do so by going to morect.com/podcasts. We will see you all soon. Bye.